We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who have devoted their lives to teaching and helping others through meditation. In today's episode, Emily Fletcher interviews the urban monk, Pandit Dasa. Pandit spent 15 years living as a monk in New York City. We'll hear about why he chose to be a monk and why he stopped. He's now an author, inspirational speaker, and meditation teacher on a mission to bring wellness into the workplace. He shares why meditation changes us. Before we begin, if you have suggestions for guests or stories, email us at untangle@gaiam.com. Here's Pandit.
So I'm so glad that you're here. It's so nice to meet you in person. So for those of you who haven't yet met Pandit Das, he is also known as the Urban Monk and has a book by that same title. So I'd love to just hit rewind a little bit and kind of introduce you to our audience in case they don't know you yet. So I think you're maybe the only second or third monk I've ever really had a chance to sit down and speak to. So it's fascinating because it's so different from what most of us are used to. So can you even tell me about how you became a monk? Did it choose you? Did you choose it?
Well, you know, it was nothing that I had planned on doing. I don't think there's anyone really on this planet, except for maybe one or two or three people, that actually plan to become a monk. It's not something you grow up saying that, you know, I really want to become a monk and live without any material possessions. I want to live without money and I want to live without family. Like, no one thinks that. We grew up wanting to surround ourselves with as much stuff and friends and popularity as possible. Nothing wrong with obviously having friends and things, but nobody plans that, and I didn't plan that either. I grew up in Southern California. My parents migrated to this country in 1980. I was 7 years old. They were selling gift items on Venice Beach, so they had a little shop, a little booth.
Where did they come from?
India, Northern India, Kanpur area. I just talked to my mom recently. She said that they worked 7 days a week. Like, for 2 years, there wasn't like a day off because they didn't have much money, and so every day money had to come in, right, just to survive. And so there I was, probably the only Indian kid on Venice Beach playing basketball, you know, boogie boarding, skateboarding, getting introduced to pizza. So I was kind of absorbing American culture, you know, and at that time they were just trying to survive. But within like a few years, within about 7 years, I don't know how they did it, but they established a multi-million-dollar jewelry business.
Wow.
Really an incredibly successful jewelry business. And our life went from having a beat up old like 1972 Toyota station wagon where my dad was driving like a 5 Series Mercedes-Benz in about 7 to 8 years. But that wasn't going to last. A lot of ups and downs in my life, which are difficult, but they also help you grow incredibly in a way that you can't really imagine growing, you know? They had a factory where they gold-plated jewelry, and that electrical plant due to heavy rains caught on fire, and we like lost everything. And when we lost everything, my dad, in an attempt to figure out a way to make money again, he decided to explore post-communist Bulgaria.
You know, from
that's what everybody does. Isn't that what everyone does?
Yeah,
you know,
Bulgaria.
Yeah. So everyone does that. So he thought he'd just do that. He went out there right after it came out of communism. So the country was like an instant, complete infancy. They had really nothing. So then he was trying to import things from India to bring in some new stuff. And he knew how to do that. That was his expertise. And so I decided to, I'm 21 at the time, and I decided to leave everything I'm doing. I was in college and just go and join him because our life was falling apart in LA.
Where were you in school?
Cal State, LA.
What were you studying?
Business. Yeah. I was expected to take over the business. I didn't know if I wanted to or not, but I don't think I knew what I wanted to do. Especially when things started to fall apart, that became really difficult and really confusing. So there we are. We left everything behind in LA and we moved to like this one tiny one bedroom apartment in Bulgaria, post-communist Bulgaria. So when you ask me whether I chose to become a monk, whether it chose me, I didn't choose it. I think my lifestyle and the events in my life guided me in that direction. And so I don't know who's doing the choosing.
Because you saw that stuff could come and it could go and it could come and it
could go. That was such a clear realization. And when I was in Bulgaria, you know, just to give you an idea what I was experiencing out there, there was hardly anybody that spoke English. Like 1 in 100 would speak English. Like imagine walking onto the streets of New York and no one understands. All of a sudden, everybody speaks a language that you've never heard before. And you can't speak to anyone. Everything on TV was in Russian or Bulgarian. All the movies that were playing in the theaters were like 2 years old, and I'd seen pretty much everything. And I found myself in this place of real deep introspection. And that's when I really started to go deeper into my own spirituality, started to meditate.
Did you start meditating on your own, or how did you start?
Well, you know, I'd already been meditating because my parents used to meditate at home. And so even in LA, they all just kind of grew up doing it.
So what was their practice? What did you grow up? What did you see them doing?
I saw them reciting some different mantras to different gods. And so I would also do that. I would light an incense. We had a little altar, offer a flower on the altar, recite some Sanskrit prayers. So I had some kind of a practice. I didn't really know what I was doing, as maybe is the case for a lot of young people. But I did enjoy it. I liked it. It made me feel connected to something greater, bigger than myself. So I did that. So I kind of had an idea of how to do meditation, but I never questioned why I'm doing it or really what am I going to get from it. But it felt good to do it. And so I just did it.
Mm-hmm.
So I luckily had some experience. So I continued that and started to go deeper within myself. And for the first time, I started asking questions about myself. Who am I? What's the purpose of life? How did I get here? Why did all of this just happen to me? Why did I end up losing everything that I had? And we're without much money and we're living in a one-bedroom apartment in a very foreign country. So why did it all get stripped away? Did I do something to deserve this? What caused all of this? I never really questioned it in such depth as I did when I was out there. And so that's where the journey began, which ultimately, making a very long story short, we moved back to the East Coast after a couple of years. And, you know, my dad's trying different things. I'm trying different things. But it was a very difficult time because, again, I was in a new part of the world. The East Coast, we didn't have any friends or family there. So I was uprooted again in one sense. And so it was...
How old are you at this point?
24, about. And then it was in 1999 that I finally decided that I need to just take a break. So I'm like, okay, I need to just get off of this roller coaster and just take a time out. So I went to a monastery in India, in Mumbai, India. Some friends had recommended that monastery to me. And I decided to go there for a month. And I was wondering if that was too long. Like, can I live in an Indian monastery for like a month? Because they're tough in the way they live and the time they wake up and their meditation. It's like a little austere. And so, but I'm like, you know, whatever it is, I got to do something really different because I need to just figure out where I was going to go. And there I was flying off to India to spend a month in the monastery. And the experience was so incredible that I ended up spending a total of 6 months in India in a few different monasteries. I traveled a little bit. And then I came back to the U.S. and moved into the monastery in New York because I wanted to continue that experience because it was the best experience I'd had in my whole life so far. Like the stuff that I was finally getting answers to the bigger questions of life. One of the things is to understand really who you are. You know, you can look at yourself in the mirror and be convinced that that's you right there. Right? But you looked at yourself in the mirror 20 years ago, and you look at yourself in the mirror now, they look very different. And 20 years from now, we're going to look probably pretty different. So is that really me? Am I always just changing? Is there something constant about me that just doesn't change? Yes. How do I see that? And that is what I got to understand. You know, living with monks and studying the books on Eastern wisdom and meditating for 2 hours a day.
So, okay, so you're in this monastery. It's the best experience of your life. Every day, 3 hours of meditation, 4 hour ceremonies. And then you move back to New York and you decide to join this monastery here in the Lower East Side, correct?
Yep.
And how long were you there? And then, so when did you officially become a monk?
So even when I moved into the New York monastery, I wasn't convinced that I wanted to live as a monk. I thought, let me just give it 6 months. 6 months went by. I'm like, it's pretty good. I like it. Another 6 months. Another 6 months. And after like the third year of doing this, I'm like, you know, maybe I should just kind of commit to doing this for a certain number of years so that my mind's not, because, you know, the thoughts are like, oh my gosh, I should start making some money. Mm-hmm. I'm like almost 30 years old. I probably should think about a family or a career. But I'm like, is it intelligent to walk away from something that I really enjoy doing? Like, and it's not just enjoy on an external level, like eating ice cream or something. It's bringing joy to my soul. And when the soul is joyous, then you just feel thoroughly satisfied. And so then I decided that, okay, I'm going to just, I think it was like 2 or 3 years went by before I said, you know, I'm going to give this a shot. I'm going to give this a real shot.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Just rewind a little bit. It's like, what's changed from like, so you're living in this monastery in the Lower East Side, and then you're like, you know what, let me give this a shot. What changes? Is that when you got your name? That's when you took the robes? Is there a ceremony? Like, what does that look like?
Actually, nothing really changed. There's no official ceremony. You can stay as long as you want to, as long as you feel comfortable, as long as you feel like you're engaged properly, you can remain as a monk. It's more of an internal decision you make. There's no like external ritual that takes place like a marriage sort of. There's no external ritual. The thing that made me commit, I can share that. You know, I get to go to bed every night knowing that I help people today, like really help them without expecting anything from them.
Beautiful.
But the biggest thing you want to learn to renounce is your ego. You want to get rid of that because that's the biggest thing to let go of. You know, we can let go of everything else in life. We can part with money. We can part with our family, but we can't part with our ego. That's really hard.
Do you think it's about divorcing yourself from it entirely, or do you think it's about bringing it into balance?
When I say ego, well, I'm talking about when somebody criticizes us or when somebody says something negative to us, we pop like a soda can. Mm-hmm. You know, there's
it's like an involuntary stress reaction.
Yeah. Or that, you know, I just feel I immediately get defensive, or I immediately blame you now or something like that. That reactive tendency because the ego got hurt. Whereas a truly humble yogi will hear that criticism and say, maybe there's some truth to this. Let me analyze it. Like really genuinely feel that way. Not get all worked up and say, okay, I'm going to just bite my tongue. And no, they're not even trying to bite their tongue. They're like, oh, okay, let me think about what just happened and maybe I can grow from this
situation.
Let
me see if there's truth in
it. Yeah, like really calmly without the ego flaring up, right?
Yeah, the way I would picture that is letting go of that backlog of built up stress in the body that, you know, is just looking for a place to come out on other people, these involuntary fight or flight stress reactions, but still perhaps maintaining this duality of, yes, I have a sense of individuality and I am connected to totality at the same time.
The world's running on ego. You know, you can look on TV, look at everywhere. It's just kind of ego's driving everybody, you know? It's so hard to be humble. You know, look at the whole political race. It's all about ego, right? It's a mudslinging contest. It's that's ego-based. Mm. Where's the humility in that, right? And so that's everywhere.
Well, I think, yes, it is in everyone and everything, but I think there is also the other side of that. I mean, in the political race, I think just as there are people who are egomaniacs and maniacal, you know, this like characters that are larger than life, I think there are also people that are emerging that actually have intentions of wanting to fix our food and fix our infrastructure and fix our economy. And so that's the thing that I'm choosing to pour my attention on.
Yeah, and so what I was saying is that ego is there, that removing ourselves from our ego or transforming it is not just the job of the monks. It's the job of the planet. That if we all do that transformation or engage in the process of that transformation, then actually, I feel, and only then is humanity really going to experience happiness. Because then we'll actually put our others in before ourselves. Right now, we put ourselves before others. Because the moment we try to put others before ourselves, I think that's, can you imagine that becoming the norm in society? Isn't that like a beautiful thought? Just others, everybody putting others before themselves. And it's hard.
So how long were you a monk?
A total of 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can't believe it. It's just like, where did the time go? It's unbelievable.
And what was, you know, in looking back in that chapter of your life, what are your biggest takeaways?
Well, I guess there's so many. But I think the teaching that I try to hold on to all the teachings, but the teachings that I'm really trying to hold on to, as difficult as they are, again, is this teaching of trying to be humble, trying to be tolerant. You know, when we talk about humility, we immediately define it as weakness, that if I'm humble, people will walk all over me, I'll be a pushover. I'll get nothing done because no one's going to respect me. No one's going to, you know, listen to me. Mm. But humility doesn't mean to think less of yourself. It means to think of yourself less, right? That means, again, putting others first. Mm. Can you imagine working without the desire for respect? Everybody wants a little respect, right? Saying that, just try not to expect it. Just keep giving to others. Just keep respecting others and don't expect it to come back. And then just see what happens, right? And try to be humble.
Beautiful. Right. So for you, it's about taking each step. It's not about necessarily accomplishing it. It's just that you're moving towards.
Yeah. We move towards how and when we accomplish it is not totally up to us also. There's higher things in this world and this universe that are guiding us. And there's going to be a lot of factors in play. But all we can really do is try our best. And if we fail, try again and we try again. That's all we can really do, you know, especially when it comes to these spiritual endeavors and self-development and growth. We have to keep trying. I think every day we have to try. The day we don't try, we'll go one step back, I think.
I recently heard someone say that if you don't do something every day that challenges you, then you're basically signaling your brain that it's ready for death. That to me speaks to a very fundamental truth of the universe is that, you know, energy is either creating or destroying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just even our muscles, if we don't use them every day, they're just going to get weaker and weaker. You work out after 6 months, you're sore all over.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And so you're a monk for 15 years.
Yes.
And then what inspired you to transition out of that?
Well, you know, so within, I think many monastic traditions of the world, you're not required to be a monk forever. You know, you could take those vows, but most people don't. You come in, you learn, you train, and you go out.
Mm. And what was that like? Did it feel foreign and weird to be out in the land? Or were you kind of already, I mean, you were living in the Lower East Side, so it wasn't, I imagine the transition wasn't that jarring as if you were like in a cave in the Himalayas.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm on the Lower East Side. Plus, my work involved dealing with a lot of people.
Right.
I mean, I was working on college campuses and I was starting to do workshops in corporations. So I was constantly dealing with working individuals, people out in the world. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm on the subways, on the buses, walking around New York City. So I was very plugged in to this culture. So, not much changed in that in one sense. I mean, there was a lot of introspection that went on, and the transition was there at times was difficult. Like, you're going to make this change now. So the making the change wasn't so difficult because I was already plugged in and doing all kinds of things. But like, whoa, I'm going to change my lifestyle. Oh, gosh, I have to think about getting married, to think about making money. So that was at times difficult, just that introspection, like, wow, what's it going to look like? How am I going to do this? There were some challenging moments too for me.
Like what?
Just the thought process, how it's going to happen, you know?
Like starting to control the how things are going to show up?
Yeah, like how am I going to start to earn a living and, you know, finding somebody and, you know, just that, you know, almost 40, right? So you're going to start, not starting your career at 22 fresh out of college. I'm getting an 18-year late start. So
what was your first date like?
My first date. So, you know, at our, we have a lot of public programs at our monastery. So she was already coming to a bunch of like the lectures and the yoga classes that were going on in there. And she was coming to a lot of my lectures. And so after I transitioned out of the monastery, then I basically approached her and yeah, she was really into it. She's like, she'd been thinking about it already. I'm like, okay, that's a relief, mm-hmm. You know? And then, our first date, I took her to an Indian restaurant to eat dosas.
Nice. And are you still with this person?
Yeah, we were engaged.
Oh,
yeah, we're engaged. So we've been together for a little over a year now.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Exciting.
So yeah, it was. It was, you know, everything happened really smoothly, actually. Much more than I thought it was going to be much harder. Everything happened. Just the thought process, like, whoa, this is kind of overwhelming. How am I going to do it? When I started to do it, everything just kind of fell into place.
Mm. And do you find that to be true, that the more you put your attention on nature, the more nature puts its attention on you?
Like, you know, for 15 years, it was basically, I was doing volunteer work, like full-on volunteer work. A good chunk of it, or a part of it, I had no bank account. You know, I just, like, I don't need it. I don't want it. So I think it's, you know, yes, meditating on all that, but also dedicating part of our life to serving.
So talk to me. I know you've spoken at Columbia and you've taught at Google and you've taught at, you know, universities and corporations. When you go to speak, what do you normally speak about and what do you feel people getting really lit up around?
Well, I speak about how to manage your mind and how to deal with your mind. Because what I'm ultimately helping people do is understand what causes them stress and how to relieve that stress. And in order for us to understand how we relieve stress, we have to understand what causes our stress. Because the immediate answer is, you know, when you ask a question, what causes you stress? Oh, my job, the deadlines, my family, my commute. But is it really all of that that's causing us stress? Or is it just the way we're perceiving all of this that's causing our stress? So I like to help people make that distinction between what we think is causing us stress and what's actually causing us stress. Is the traffic jam that's preventing you from getting to your appointment on time causing you stress? Or is it just you getting worked up that you're not going to get there and freaking out that you're not going to get there that's causing you stress? You know, and if we can understand that it's really our mind that does that, because even if the traffic jam clears up and you're not going to get there, you're still angry and upset because you let it get to you, all right? And so just to understand that we have a switch where we can control that stress level by seeing that, okay, maybe it's not meant to be. And me being upset and angry isn't going to change the situation right now, right? So, and I want people to be able to go internal and understand really what is the cause of our stress is our unhealthy and untrained mind. That is really 99% of the problem. Because the worst problems can be seen in almost a positive light, just by a little adjustment in the mind. But that mind, that adjustment can't be made without really some serious meditation training. And so I talk about stress management. I talk about mindfulness. I talk about meditation because the mind is on its automatic pilot 24/7. It comes up with dialogue, unnecessary dialogue taking place. You're arguing with someone in your mind who might have upset you yesterday, and you were having an argument with that person in our mind. Person's not there. We're arguing and getting ourselves stressed out. Who's doing that? We are doing that. Our mind is doing that. And did you know that we were powerless? Like, you didn't choose to mess up your day by having this argument in your head. It started automatically. And you can't even realize when it started. How long? Like 3 minutes ago, 3.5 minutes. It's been going on. And we didn't realize it. So when we understand that it's this vehicle that runs on autopilot, and then we can catch ourselves like, oh, it's on automatic pilot again. Oh, pause. Because before, it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on for like days. You can be having the same argument with somebody. But now when you know that it's doing it, but then you have a say in that. And now I can choose to press pause. Take a deep breath, say, okay, wait, I got to step away from these thoughts. They're meaningless. They're not doing any good whatsoever for me right now, except stressing me out. Right? So I talk about this and then teach meditation, breathing, focusing techniques that really help relieve people's tension and anxiety, and also gives them a nice awareness of what's happening in their mind. It helps them take inventory of what's really going on up there, you know? And when you understand what's going on up there, then you can deal with it better. It's like, then you're able to almost see your mind and see your thoughts, kind of like looking inside of an aquarium and seeing the fish swimming around, right? So you're no longer one of the fish. You stepped outside, now you're looking at them. And when you can look at them from outside, then you're no longer wet like the fish in the water. You know, you kind of removed yourself. Empowering people and handing them the pause button to their mind. And that, I think, is the biggest factor. And then helping them understand that if a regular meditation practice is implemented into their life, then they can strengthen that muscle of the mind. Every muscle needs to be worked out regularly to be strong. Right? And same thing with the mind. It's a muscle. If it's not worked out, it's going to be weak. And when it's weak, it'll keep having those crazy dialogues. It'll keep reflecting on painful things from a year or two or 3 or 5 years ago. If it becomes stronger and trained and well-nourished, then we can stop ourselves quickly before it takes us down the negative, dark road and think of more positive things and move on with our day.
I love two concepts I really love from that. One, we have a mind, we are not our mind. And two, I love that. I've never heard that before, that instead of you being one of the fish in the fish tank, you step out and you start to see your thoughts as the fish in the fish tank. I think that's a really helpful image for people. Yeah, beautiful. So where can we find you? I know people can get your book, which is called Urban Monk, Exploring Karma, Consciousness, and the Divine, which is such a beautiful title. And we can get that on Amazon, mm-hmm. Yes. And then I know people can find your website, which is consciouslivingnyc.com.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for your lifetime of service and for all of the work that you
thank
do.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you and meeting you.
Yeah, it finally happened.
Yes.
Thanks so much to Emily and Pandit, and thank you all for listening. If you want to learn more about Pandit, go to consciouslivingnewyorkcity.com. We look forward to sharing more inspiring stories next week. Once again, if you have feedback or suggestions for guests or stories, email us at untangle@gayam.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio app in the App Store. See you next time.